Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
The Airbnb in Savannah, Georgia was just one more stop in a long line of temporary homes. Their 50th rental since they started running. Maybe their 60th. By then, Nicholas Kasotis had stopped keeping count. What mattered wasn't the number, it was survival. Staying ahead of whoever was hunting them.
We never knew when we would move. We never knew when we would move out. Sometimes we'd be in a place for 6 or 7 weeks. You know, those were rare but wonderful. And sometimes it would be every 2 or 3 days. Sometimes with literally an hour to pack. You have to be out of the house in an hour. This is where you're going. This is the code to get in. Pack your things.
By November 2022, Nicholas and his wife, Mindy, had been living this way for over 4 years. Constant movement. Always looking over their shoulders. Friends could only reach them through Signal, an encrypted app where messages vanished as soon as they were read. Ordinary phones, ordinary email, ordinary life. They'd been told it was all being monitored by the people who wanted them dead. For Mindy, that meant staying inside.
On her average day, she would not leave the house at all. She was terrified that she would be killed if she did. I was always terrified to leave the house.
Nicholas only ventured out when he had to, for groceries or a quick errand. Even then, he was still gripped with fear.
If we stayed in one place too long, we might be found, that it was dangerous. I was frankly terrified. I was absolutely terrified all of the time.
Join me now as we examine the bizarre and tragic case of Mindy Kasotis, a decorated Navy officer and his wife convinced they were being hunted, living in constant fear and secrecy, until a grisly discovery in the Georgia woods revealed the truth about who the real threat had been all along. Nicholas Kasotis was born in Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire in 1982.
You talk about one stoplight towns, and we don't even have a full stoplight. It's one of those flashing ones. It's a rural area. It's heavily forested. I grew up on a dirt road, kind of in the middle of the woods.
Despite his small town beginnings, Nicholas had ambitions that reached far beyond the dirt roads of Fitzwilliam.
After high school, I went to Boston University for college. I got my bachelor's there in 2004, and then I went to the Northeastern University School of Law, also in Boston. I got my JD, which is your basic law degree. I passed the Massachusetts bar that year and joined the United States Navy as a judge advocate.
He was now a part of the Navy's Judge Advocate General Corps, the JAGS, commissioned officers who served as both lawyers and military leaders. Think Tom Cruise and A Few Good Men.
I went on active duty starting in early 2008 after completing some training, and then I reported to my first duty station in Norfolk, Virginia, where I was a defense attorney and a legal assistance attorney. While I was there, I deployed twice.
From Norfolk, Nicholas's career took him overseas to Italy, then back to Washington, D.C.
After Italy, I was stationed at the Pentagon for a couple years. When I first got there, I was an administrative law attorney. I started going at night to get my LLM, which is a master's in law. And I got that at Georgetown University, focusing mostly on cybersecurity and privacy-related issues.
In 2009, Nicholas married his first wife, Heather Bassett.
It was not great. We had a lot of issues, I think, kind of throughout, to the point where I later heard the night before our wedding, she told somebody publicly that she didn't think it was going to last. I was deployed a lot. I was deployed for a large chunk of our engagement. I was deployed within 2 months of us getting married. I don't think either of those is also a good step for marital success, but I think we had a lot of disagreements kind of throughout our marriage. Filed for divorce on September 1st of 2015, and it was granted about a month and a half later.
By September 2015, Nicholas was divorced and back into the dating pool. That's when he met a woman who would change his life forever.
I met Mindy on September 18th, 2015. We had met on a dating website called OkCupid, and we had talked for, I don't know, maybe a week or so, and then we met at a restaurant in Alexandria, Virginia. It's a restaurant kind of right down by the water. It's a nice little spot.
Mindy Mebbin was 33 years old at the time. Originally from Louisiana, she'd grown up in a close-knit family with her parents, Frank and Betsy, and her two brothers. She'd earned her bachelor's degree from Armstrong State University in Savannah, Georgia, before heading to Virginia Tech for a master's in public and international affairs, a leap that eventually landed her in Washington, D.C., working for law firms and nonprofits. She was smart, ambitious, and independent. On paper, she looked like the perfect match for a polished Navy JAG officer.
I would say within a month, we were talking about marriage, you know, starting to look at wedding venues. It happened very quickly. And we married just over a year later, on October 9th, 2016.
Excited for the new lives together, Nicholas and Mindy Kasotis started planning their future.
In 2017, we were discussing starting a family, several things. We were discussing my upcoming departure from active duty. I want to say September of 2017, I left active duty. At that point, I went to a Department of the Navy job with the Board for Correction of Naval Records.
After a decade as a decorated naval officer, Nicholas traded in his lieutenant commander stripes for a civilian position with the Department of the Navy. But just when things should have been falling into place, things started getting weird for Nicholas and Mindy.
Mindy was very actively watching all of our spending because she wanted to make sure that we were in the best position financially. And she started noticing odd deductions from our accounts that weren't tied to anything that we were doing. Sometimes they seemed to be, the ones she showed me were, they didn't even have transaction numbers. It would just say something like payment and, you know, hundreds of dollars would go missing. At the time, we thought it was an error with our bank. We did not think that this was a serious issue. Sometime in late 2017, we had seen kind of a brief reprieve where we thought that things had, you know, our bank had fixed the issues, that things were no longer going wrong. And suddenly it kind of restarted with a lot more than it had before, and we also started seeing vandalism at our house. Nails in our tires, a broken window, things of that nature. I mean, you know, we wouldn't even move our cars some days, and it would have a new hole in the tire. I would sometimes get anonymous emails stating that I was going to be hurt or killed. Our mail would go missing, things of that nature.
What started as small, strange banking errors began spiraling into something darker. Broken windows, slashed tires, even threats over email.
I reported that to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I filed a complaint there, and I believe Mindy also filed a complaint there. The mail, my understanding, was a federal crime, as well as the banking issues. And since they all seemed, I imagine that they were all connected, I did not think going to local law enforcement would accomplish anything except for a police report.
Given his own background as a Navy lawyer at the Pentagon, Nicholas already knew FBI agents. Turning to them felt like the right move. And then, just a few days later, Mindy called him at work with unexpected news.
Mindy said that an FBI agent had come to the house. I asked her what they had talked about. She said that he was there in regards to what had been happening to us, that he would be returning in the near future. He came back a couple days later, Jim McIntyre. He came to the house. He had called to schedule it to make sure that I was going to be home at the time. He seemed very thorough, very professional. He wanted to know everything that had happened. He wanted copies of the emails that we had received. He wanted specific issues with the banks. We printed out screenshots of the charges that showed what had been going on, and we provided all that to him. And he said that it was something he took seriously and that he would be investigating it.
Nicholas and Mindy felt reassured. Not only was the FBI involved, but Agent Jim McIntyre seemed genuinely interested in helping them.
I read multiple news reports of people who'd undergone cyber stalking and cyber crimes, and often it seemed like their big battle was getting somebody to believe what was going on, getting law enforcement to take it seriously, getting law enforcement who had jurisdiction over the crimes to take it seriously. And I thought we were lucky. I said many times how lucky we were.
Over the next several months, McIntyre told the couple he was digging deeper into their case.
He advised us that he believed that this was an overseas hacking group of some sort that was targeting members of the military. He said that we should relax somewhat because he believed that the local vandalism and things of that nature were likely something they were paying kids to do or something of that nature. We were not in real danger. It was meant to be harassing us, and that he was continuing to investigate it.
As the weather cools, I'm swapping in the pieces that actually get the job done. Warm, durable, and built to last. And Quince delivers every time, with wardrobe staples that carry you through the season. Quince has the kind of fall staples you actually want to wear on repeat, like 100% Mongolian cashmere for just $60, classic fit denim, and real leather and wool outerwear that looks sharp and holds up. Both my son and I have our eyes on the suede trucker jacket. It's perfect for layering and looks really casual but put together. Knowing him, he'll probably get his first. By partnering directly with ethical factories and top artisans, Quince cuts out the middleman to deliver premium quality at half the cost of similar brands. We've had a pretty crazy week weather-wise here. Over the weekend and early this week, it was so hot. On Monday, I was wearing the Pro-Tech 7-inch golf short and performance jersey golf polo. And then overnight, the temperature drops, and I'm sitting here recording this in my Flowknit performance joggers and the 100% Merino wool all-season long-sleeve base layer tee, which I originally bought for winter camping, but I seem to wear it all the time because it's so comfortable. Layer up this fall with pieces that feel as good as they look. Go to quince.com/madness for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/madness. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/madness. By early 2018, Nicholas and Mindy believed Jim McIntyre was more than just an FBI agent investigating their case. He wasn't only helping them navigate bank fraud and vandalism. He began stepping directly into their personal lives, offering advice, solutions, even opportunities. And one of those opportunities was financial. Knowing Nicholas had a law degree and a background in cybersecurity, Jim told him he could connect him with a software company he claimed to work with. It sounded like the perfect solution. Nicholas could earn a living while working from home, and Mindy wouldn't have to be left alone.
At that point, I believed I was being employed by a software company that Jim McIntyre had connected me to. The nature of their business was AI software development. The name changed multiple times over the years that I believe I worked there. The ending name was Apis Limited. I believed that he was helping me because of our situation, that he knew people, you know, which is not uncommon, private sector and the government on criminal, especially cyber investigations, often have to work very hand in hand. And as I had talked to him, and I was hoping to find something that would allow me to work from home, because despite his reassurances that he did not think at that time we were in real danger, I was very uncomfortable leaving Mindy home alone.
But with Nicholas's new job, that hardly seemed like an issue. His compensation wasn't a paycheck. It came in stock options. And when a major licensing deal closed in 2018, those options suddenly skyrocketed.
Because there was a large sale or licensing agreement that was completed at some point. I wasn't getting paid by this company. I was paid only in stock options. And I was told that this large sum of money was being given to me. I believe this was late 2018. It honestly felt kind of like a lottery ticket. It was something that I had never expected.
Almost overnight, Nicholas's shares were valued at more than $32 million. But that kind of sudden wealth brought on its own problems.
But we had real issues with getting a large chunk of money because we couldn't put a couple hundred dollars into our account without it going missing within a matter of minutes, if not hours. So during that time, Jim McIntyre, he set up a trust. He showed us extensive documentation where it would be invested and, you know, care would be taken of it. And it wouldn't be anything that we could touch until it was safe to do so.
The $32 million windfall couldn't have come at a more convenient time. Because just as Nicholas was coming into money, his past was calling. In 2015, he divorced his first wife, Heather. And by late 2018, she was back in court, claiming he hadn't lived up to his financial obligations.
She filed some sort of a complaint in court saying that I was not fulfilling my obligations under a divorce decree. Jim had suggested to me to make an offer to her, both because in the lead-up, we were unsure if Heather might be involved in what was going on against us. She was one of many suspects that he discussed with us. He went into really great depth in everybody in our life.
In late 2018, Nicholas offered to pay Heather $1.5 million to settle the divorce once and for all.
And he said that she was not involved in what was going on, that he had wired the money. I had a wire confirmation and I had bank documents later showing that money coming out of the trust, and I assumed that everything was settled.
The settlement with Heather should have been the end of one chapter in Nicholas's life, but instead, it opened the door to another. Because while one conflict was closing, a new one was already taking shape, closer to home and harder to escape. The vandalism and threats against Nicholas and Mindy didn't stop.
2018 into early 2019, a lot had happened. In May, we were told to leave our house. We were in contact with Mr. McIntyre. He said that there were arrests being made and that he was worried we would not be safe if we stayed there, that somebody might do something rash. And we were terrified. We kind of grabbed our dog and we went down to Williamsburg, Virginia. We kind of huddled down there for the weekend and came back thinking that everything was over. It was not over. Things continued. If anything, it picked up pace. The money going disappearing, the issues with our bank accounts, the issues, you know, with emails, mail, vandalism of our house.
By this point, Nicholas and Mindy had been living in fear for more than a year, and they were desperate for a way out. According to Nicholas, Jim had told them to leave quietly, this time for Charlottesville, Virginia. He said he even arranged a rental where they could stay.
The night that we arrived there, or possibly the next day, I was assaulted at the house that he had set up as a long-term rental. I was attacked from behind. Somebody hit me with something hard. I don't know if it was a board or a baseball bat or something, but I was hit multiple times. I was kicked in the face.
Nicholas and Mindy had clearly been followed.
He had told me that I was being targeted by members of my family, most specifically my father, Wayne Casotas. I did believe that. At that time, we had been looking at literally everyone in our lives. You know, my ex-wife, Mindy's ex-boyfriend, a former boss of Mindy's best friend who had tried to assault her at one point, anyone who might have ill will held against us. At some point, he had come back to us in mid to late 2019 and said, I have information that this is being perpetrated by your family. At the time, he said he assumed it was financial because of this large amount of money that we had received.
Not long after his marriage to Mindy, Nicholas and his family had become estranged from one another. And now, Nicholas believed they were trying to harm him. By the end of 2019, Nicholas and Mindy were constantly on the move, and every move they made was under Jim McIntyre's direction.
I gave Jim McIntyre access to literally everything. I believed because of the investigation and that it was necessary. You know, my bank accounts, my email accounts, absolutely everything. And so did Mindy. He had a spare key to our home as well as the alarm code while we lived there. He had all of our bank accounts. He had, at this point, our mail. So he had access to that, all of our social media, both of our social media. He also had our Signal. So Signal is a encrypted messaging app. You can mirror Signal from your phone to a computer. He had us mirror our Signal accounts so that he could monitor those conversations as well. We couldn't even log into our bank accounts.
Nicholas and Mindy lived in constant fear, never settled, never certain where they'd end up next.
Mindy throughout this stretch had some health issues, been very sick back in February, and then had something that we just didn't understand in June. Mr. McIntyre took her to the hospital. This was a concern of ours throughout, that when she was seeking medical treatment, because of our insurance, because of our last names, that this was going to pop up somewhere that could potentially be used to identify us. Was at the hospital for a couple days. She had some sort of a spell. She started shaking uncontrollably. Her eyes were very, very large. Her pupils dilated almost to the edge of her eyes. I was absolutely terrified. They tested her extensively and couldn't find anything over the period of 2 or 3 days, and she was better and returned.
By the spring of 2020, Nicholas and Mindy were reaching their breaking point. For more than 2 years, they'd handed over their banking, their security, even the decision-making to Jim McIntyre.
We were very angry with Jim at this time, promising things and then not delivering on them for a long time. And we were trying to assert some boundaries with him. I had a conversation with him, and I made some reference to wanting to speak to his superior. And it was at this time that we learned that Mr. McIntyre was not a federal agent. He said, "Nick, I'm not an FBI agent. Why would you think of that?"
It was the first time Nicholas says he realized he'd never actually verified Jim's credentials. And then he thought back to the first day they'd met.
Mindy, she told me at the time that she'd seen a badge. I had no reason to doubt that he was who he said he was.
And now, Jim finally revealed the truth.
I learned that he was the majority investor in this company that I was working for.
Jim wasn't law enforcement after all. He was a businessman, the largest backer of the company Nicholas worked for. He claimed he'd picked Nicholas to serve as the company's attorney, and from that point forward, everything he did was, in his words, about protecting him. Protecting him from who? From the very people Jim insisted were out to get them. Nicholas's family, his ex-wife, and anyone else who might want access to the money. The lie was staggering, but in Nicholas and Mindy's eyes, the motive almost sounded noble.
Probably the worst argument that Mindy and I ever had. Cut ties with Jim, like, I feel like I've been lied to for years. Mindy felt that Jim was our angel. She said, you know, he'd made mistakes, but, you know, we would be in the position to fix all those mistakes. And if we stopped working together, then who knows if his resolve to see this end in our favor was going to go away.
After a long discussion, Mindy and Nicholas decided to stay with Jim, who continued moving them from rental to rental every few weeks.
Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. Colin and I are getting ready to launch the brand new season of Undisclosed Toward Justice, The State versus Amanda Lewis. The new season drops September 1st, so stay subscribed, find us on your favorite podcast apps, and check out the trailer for this upcoming season.
911.
I need an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
My daughter fell in the pond when she's not breathing.
On August 8th, 2007, the small town of Esto, Florida, was rocked by a 911 call in which Amanda Lewis said her 7-year-old daughter had drowned in their above-ground pool.
My assumption was she went over the side of the pool, went down, hit her head, and came back up.
But the case soon took a sharp turn when Amanda's 6-year-old son spoke to the police that night.
Mom, I don't think my sister.
What does that mean?
But is it possible that this is a case where there's more or less than meets the eye?
In February 2021, Nicholas and Mindy moved to Hilton Head, where they lived with Mindy's brother, Frank IV, and his wife, Megan. Betsy and Frank III were also living there. For the next 16 months, Mindy and Nicholas lived side by side with their family, and it was the longest they'd stayed in one place. From the very beginning of their ordeal, they kept Mindy's family updated on the threats they were facing. And if anyone in her family had ever doubted how serious their situation really was, those doubts disappeared once they saw Mindy's fear for themselves. She refused to leave the house unless it was absolutely necessary, terrified that if she ever stepped outside, she wouldn't come back alive. In the summer of 2022, Mindy's brother decided to sell the house. That meant Nicholas and Mindy had to move again, this time to Savannah, Georgia, where they rented an Airbnb. Mindy's parents would also move in with them.
At that point, I did have an income. I had sold a short story to Sony Pictures and had made several $100,000. And we had managed to get that money. And one of our boundaries with Jim was we were going to understand where we lived, how long we lived there, and we were going to pay for it.
And it was there, in Savannah, that Nicholas and Mindy got the news they hadn't dared to hope for.
Mindy told me that she was pregnant. We were still at Frank and Megan's when she said she had taken a pregnancy test and that it was positive.
By Thanksgiving of 2022, Mindy was deep into her third trimester and struggling.
Mindy was not doing well. Her pregnancy was very difficult. She had a lot of health issues. I was helping her take her blood pressure every night. I was helping her get in and out of bed. I thought that she was really physically struggling, and I was trying to help her and trying to ensure that she and the baby were okay.
Mindy's mother, Betsy, remembers that time vividly inside the rental house in Savannah.
They actually were sort of hiding out because we were told they feared for their lives. Nick was supposed to be working for Microsoft, and he had taken on work for some smaller company underneath Microsoft, and he had solved some kind of an algorithm, and they were giving him company stock. He would get up in the morning and work all through the day on his computer and into the early morning hours. There was supposed to be people after them. They had security, and she was truly fearful for her life. She was scared to death to leave the house. So she'd been having some blood pressure problems. Sometimes she would lay down at night so that she could stay up until Nick would come to bed.
For Thanksgiving, Betsy and her husband Frank went back to Hilton Head to spend the holiday with family and left on Wednesday, November 23rd. While Mindy's parents were away, Nicholas went apartment shopping, hoping to find a long-term rental for Betsy and Frank. But while he was out, he received a frightening message from Mindy.
I got a message from her that she was leaving the home. She was concerned and she was going to get medical attention. I asked her if she thought I should come back, and she said that she was going to be picked up and that she was all right. She was going to be taken to a birthing center that a doctor who had been seeing her in the home worked at or was affiliated with in some way. Mr. McIntyre was comfortable with that because we were very scared, again, about the medical issues, with insurance, with payments, with our location being found.
According to Nicholas, he was told not to visit Mindy in the birthing center.
I continued to receive signal messages from Mindy over the next several days.
Frank and Betsy returned home on Sunday, November 27th, to find Mindy wasn't there.
We were told on Monday that Nick had taken her to the hospital. They were going to do some testing and try to work on her blood pressure. And so we were happy that she was actually, maybe they could figure out what was wrong with, her blood pressure and get her feeling better. It was supposed to be some type of military hospital on a base. we just knew they were doing testing. I didn't know where. We were in Savannah, so we thought it was probably the base close to Savannah.
I got messages Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday that I thought were from her. Everything seemed positive. And Thursday, I received a phone call and was told she'll be ready to pick up this afternoon. I'd sent her a few messages that hadn't heard back. I assumed she was either napping or undergoing some sort of test that she didn't have her phone with her. And I never saw Mindy again.
On the evening of Thursday, December 1st, Nicholas went to the clinic where Mindy was supposed to be receiving care.
I was brought back. He's kind of waiting for me. I was brought to an office, and I assumed I was getting some sort of instruction on aftercare. And he sat me down and said, you know, I'm very sorry to tell you that Mindy passed away very suddenly today. I was an absolute wreck. He said that she had died very suddenly, that she had been brought back from some testing and had gone to the bathroom, and that the nurse was called away before she was done in the bathroom, and that by the time they came back to rehook her up to her machines, she had passed away. But my understanding was that there was going to be an autopsy, so I assumed that she was being prepped for that or she had already been transported somewhere for that.
Betsy remembers the moment Nicholas walked through the door.
I heard him come in the door, so I came bouncing out and I was like, hey, how's Mindy doing? And he just started bawling, crying hysterically, and talking, and I really couldn't even understand much of what he said. All I could really understand was she's not coming home. The way he was crying, I figured it was not good.
Mindy Kasotis was only 40 years old when she died. Days later, Nicholas received more news.
I was told that Mindy's body had been cremated. This was information I had gotten third hand from Mr. McIntyre. Livid. Absolutely livid, because I believed that I was going to get to see her before she was cremated.
In the wake of Mindy's death, Nicholas left Savannah, promising Betsy and Frank he'd return soon, that he'd hold a memorial for Mindy and for the baby. He just needed to take care of some business first.
We thought that was his responsibility. We weren't going to say, hey, we want to take care of the body when she's married to him, so... We thought he was going to handle it.
But weeks turned into months, and Nicholas never came back. For Betsy and Frank, the loss was unbearable. Their daughter was gone, their grandchild too. And still, no chance to say goodbye. The story you've heard so far is the same one Nicholas Kasotis had been telling for years. It's the story he told Mindy's parents, the story he told police, and the story he repeated again in court. But in December of 2022, a very different story began to surface. One that started in the deep woods of rural Georgia and cast serious doubt on every word Nicholas had ever said. The Portal Hunting Club in southeastern Georgia stretches across thousands of acres of dense forest. It was December 2nd, 2022, the weekend after Thanksgiving, at the peak of deer season.
That weekend, there were hunters out. Family weekend, they were all out for deer season.
This is Lori Bayo, assistant DA for the state of Georgia.
The Portal Hunting Club is a dog club. That means is that when they hunt, they use dogs to do the hunt. And the dogs run out into the woods and the deer run, and then the hunters shoot. One of those hunters shot a deer. And the dogs that he was using went to retrieve the buck. Dogs just weren't acting right. When he said come back, dogs weren't acting right. So he went to look to figure out what was going on. He did not expect what he found.
Near a logging road in a shallow ditch, the hunter thought he'd come across the remains of an animal. But as he moved closer, he realized it wasn't an animal at all. It was human.
He found a headless, legless torso, completely nude, with two arms. One almost severed. Her two legs severed. Her head severed, just off the roadway.
The hunters immediately called police, and within 15 minutes, The hunting grounds were swarmed with law enforcement, but what they uncovered was only the beginning.
The crime scene investigator shows up, and they start documenting the crime scene. But the torso wasn't all that was found on that first day of December 2nd of 2022. And that investigator recovered not just the torso, but the tubs that were used to transport it.
Two large storage bins were found nearby, black and gray plastic totes, the kind often used to store holiday decorations. Inside them, investigators found blood. And not far from the ditch, they discovered a knife.
A Milwaukee, orange-handled, black-sheathed knife. And that knife had a cleansing wipe wrapped around it. Those wipes were everywhere. There were lots of them that were recovered. The killer didn't want to leave behind evidence. It started with the knife and the tubs, and then it gets worse.
Over the next 5 days, investigators combed the forest and scattered across 3 miles. They found the missing body parts.
The head, unfortunately, wasn't found until 5 days later, buried. By some miracle, that head was found, by some disturbed dirt by the roadway.
The medical examiner's findings were devastating. The woman's body had been severed with power tools. 9 devastating blows had left deep lacerations and fractures on the victim's skull, while the arm showed marks of someone trying to defend themselves, and her abdomen carried 3 stab wounds. Still, the pathologist couldn't say with certainty which of those injuries had ended the victim's life. What was clear was whoever this person was, they'd suffered a violent death. And now investigators faced a single, urgent question. Who was she?
They tried to test her fingerprints. They weren't on record. They did her DNA. It wasn't in the system. They went ahead and they checked. After the autopsy, she had actually on the right side a dental implant, like a crown. They couldn't track that, but they tried.
The Georgia Bureau of Investigation tried everything to identify the woman found in the woods. Fingerprints, DNA, dental records, all dead ends. Having no leads, Special Agent Lindsay Smith turned to a forensic artist.
So initially, I received a photograph from the autopsy of the face, and my initial request to the forensic artist was to ask if she could make the picture look better so that it could be released to the media. We were able to provide height, possible weight, and the hair type, essentially. We were able to create a flyer, per se, with the photograph on it and some additional identifying information.
An artist's sketch of Jane Doe was released to the public on December 11th. A second portrait went out on January 3rd, 2023. But still, no one came forward.
So I reached out to another special agent in charge within the GBI who had had success in identifying an unidentified individual. He put me in contact with an FBI agent. They were in the process of doing some genetic genealogy testing, and I reached out to him to see if he could help us with this particular case. We did have to send them a sample of blood that was obtained from the autopsy.
By early 2023, the FBI had joined the case. Using cutting-edge genetic genealogy, scientists compared the woman's DNA to public databases, searching for relatives.
So during the testing, they were able to basically build a family tree with connections to potential family members of the victim, and she was identified as a possible mother.
In May 2023, GBI agents arrived at the workplace of Betsy Mebben. She had no idea why they were there.
It was sometime after lunch, and I was going to walk over to Starbucks to get a coffee, and my friend Toby called me and asked me where I was and said, "Get back here, the GBI's here to see you."
Agents told Betsy they were investigating an unidentified murder victim, and that according to their testing, there was a 99% chance the woman was her daughter, Mindy. Betsy was stunned. None of it made sense. Nonetheless, she agreed to provide a DNA sample for comparison, and on May 11th, the results confirmed the test. The remains found in the woods or Mindy. The agents then asked Betsy about Nicholas.
We were talking about Mr. Kisotis, and I said, you probably don't know, but he died several months ago. In February, we were notified by his security team that he had been in a car accident and wasn't in very good shape, and we asked if we would be allowed to come and see him. Several weeks later, we were told that unfortunately he had died.
Betsy explained that she'd been told Nicholas was already dead, killed in a car accident earlier that year. She even shared the emails she'd received from the so-called security team, confirming the story. But to her shock, the agents corrected her.
Kind of gave me a sad look and said, no, he's not dead.
And then came another devastating revelation. The autopsy confirmed Mindy hadn't been pregnant at the time of her death. For Betsy, it meant that everything she thought she knew, for months, if not years, had all been a lie. By this point, agents had already been tracking Nicholas for weeks, ever since Mindy was flagged as a likely victim. And they found him in Pennsylvania. He changed his legal name and was already remarried to another woman. And once investigators started digging into Nicholas, it didn't take long for the evidence against him to pile up. On November 29th, 2022, a surveillance camera caught Nicholas driving his Ford Explorer down a remote logging road, the same road where Mindy's body would be discovered 3 days later. During that window, Nicholas's cell phone was powered off. What he didn't realize was that his car had its own built-in cellular system. Data pulled from the vehicle showed him lingering near the Portal Hunting Club for nearly 2 hours. Plenty of time to dispose of a body. Investigators also traced the Milwaukee knife found at the scene to a Home Depot. Store surveillance and receipts showed Nicholas purchasing the exact knife just hours before Mindy's remains were dumped. He was caught on camera holding it. Then came the forensic evidence. Mindy's DNA was found on the inside of blood-soaked plastic totes left in the woods. Her blood spatter was also discovered in the Airbnb she and Nicholas had been staying in. It was proof she'd been attacked in that home. So by the time investigators confirmed the victim was Mindy Kisotis, they already had a strong case. Nicholas was arrested the very next day, on May 11, 2023. In two separate interviews, he repeated the same bizarre story he'd told everyone else. That for 5 years, he and Mindy had been under the control of a man named Jim McIntyre. He swore he had nothing to do with their murder, dismemberment, or disposal. But the evidence told a very different story. The investigators weren't buying a word of it. Because beyond the mountain of physical and circumstantial proof, there was one more problem. There was no Jim McIntyre. He wasn't real. In fact, Nicholas couldn't produce a single shred of evidence that such a man had ever existed. And so, Nicholas Kisotis was formally charged with malice murder. The trial of Nicholas Kisotis began in August 2025, and it was one of the most bizarre trials ever prosecuted in the state of Georgia. For years, Nicholas had leaned on the same explanation for everything. A man named Jim McIntyre. Missing money? Jim was handling it. Strange behavior? Jim's security protocols. But prosecutors believed they'd discovered the real motive behind the lies. In late 2018, Nicholas had been ordered to pay his ex-wife Heather $1.5 million in their divorce settlement. Nicholas didn't have $1.5 million, and he certainly never had $32 million in a trust fund somewhere. Not wanting to be arrested for contempt of court, Nicholas and Mindy went on the run. Simple as that. Nicholas still insisted that Jim McIntyre had taken care of the payment, and that it came as a shock to learn Heather never received the money. To prove otherwise, prosecutors called Cameron Nelson, a former Navy colleague who'd once considered Nicholas a friend.
We worked together, socialized together, both with our colleagues and their spouses as well. He explained that he did not have access to any of the money that was in his account and was struggling to pay bills, common bills, and very basic level bills like vet bills, medical bills for Mindy, food, and was in distress. In May of 2018, he asked for $2,000 in cash, which I did provide.
Cameron agreed to help when Nicholas and Mindy said they needed to leave town for their own safety.
In November 2019, we opted to use a credit card so that we could easily track what was being spent, knowing that it might go up after they left the area because there would be housing expenses as well.
Over the next 18 months, Nicholas used Cameron's credit card to pay for dozens of rentals.
In total, approximately $198,000. That was a loan. On two separate occasions, Nick indicated that he intended to repay and had either set up a wire transfer to repay us or had actually gotten a cashier's check, and those never materialized. We decided that it was just not sustainable to continue to allow him to borrow money.
Nicholas testified that Jim McIntyre must have been using Cameron's credit card without his knowledge, but the prosecution argued Nicholas had simply been stealing from a sympathetic friend. And then they revealed what they believed was the second motive for Mindy's murder. 2 months before her death, Nicholas had begun a flirtatious online relationship with author Samantha Kolyasnik.
In late September 2022, I had a public Twitter. He messaged me to let me know that he had bought four of my books. I said, thank you for buying my books. And then he just kind of, he like messaged again and he just kept messaging. And then we just started engaging in small talk like off and on through October. He told me that he was a widower, that he had lost his wife and his unborn child 2 years prior, and that they had both died in a hospital. I think the first time we had a phone call was in November of 2022. It became, you know, flirtatious and more, I'd say, emotionally charged.
While the flirting was going on, Nicholas and Mindy were still living with their parents in Savannah. Yet Nicholas was telling Samantha he was a widower.
I met him in person for the first time December 16th, 2022, in Pennsylvania.
That's just 15 days after Nicholas told Mindy's parents she died in a hospital. Soon after, Nicholas changed his name from Kasotis to Stark. He was engaged to Samantha. 2 months later, they were officially married. 3 weeks later, Nicholas was arrested for murder.
I don't think words will ever capture how I felt, but I felt, if I had to choose some words, I'd say horrified, shocked, traumatized, violated, deceived.
For 6 days, prosecutors laid out their case.
There were 9 traumatic injuries to her skull. She did not do those to herself. The only person that had access to her was Mr. Kasotis. There were defensive wounds, which indicated that she herself received those wounds from somebody else while she was alive. We don't know when she took her last breath. She could have taken that at any stage along the way. There is plenty of evidence before this jury that Mr. Kasotis went to extreme measures to purchase latex gloves, to purchase Clorox wipes, to purchase the knife on the very day that he then dumps her body. There's evidence that he himself transported those totes with him, and there is no dispute that they were a black and gray tote, which is what is sitting as I look at them in this courtroom.
Nicholas then took the stand in his own defense, and once again, every answer circled back to Jim McIntyre.
Mr. Kasotis,
in anticipation of today's date, you located Mr. McIntyre, right?
No, ma'am.
So you've been talking to him basically on and off for, since what, 2017?
I started talking to him in fall of 2017, I believe, and we last spoke in, I want to say, mid-April of 2023.
And the records for APIS Limited, you subpoenaed those records in anticipation of court, correct?
No, ma'am.
You know what a subpoena is as an attorney, right, sir?
I do, ma'am.
And you knew that Mr. McIntyre was a majority investor, I think is the phrasing that you used, right?
That was what I believed, ma'am.
You hired a private investigator to find him?
No, ma'am. I hoped the state would do that, but y'all didn't really care that much.
Nicholas's defense strategy seemed to be that while he couldn't prove Jim McIntyre existed, the state couldn't prove he didn't. But what the state could prove was that with or without Jim McIntyre, Nicholas's story collapsed under its own weight.
So your testimony, that's not your tote?
No, ma'am, it is not. My testimony is that it is not my tote.
So to your testimony, this is not the knife you purchased on November 29th, 2022 at Home Depot?
That is definitively not the knife that I purchased at Home Depot. I have never seen that knife before. It was introduced as evidence.
You worked for Apis Security, correct?
I believe so, ma'am.
You never got a single paycheck?
Not paid to me, no.
So for 5 years, you worked for a company and got zero money handed to you?
Yes, ma'am.
You didn't get a single document at any point in any of the time after her death?
No, ma'am, I did not.
Death certificates, they're registered with the state of Georgia. You never got a single copy of a document from a courthouse?
No, ma'am. I asked about it once and I should have followed up, but I did not.
You yourself as an attorney never got a single document?
No, ma'am. I was lied to about Mindy's death and I did not have a document because there were no documents.
But you don't know your wife's doctor's name?
I was never given her doctor's name.
You didn't ask?
No.
Did you ask?
I did not ask.
So for years, you had been trying to get pregnant?
Yes, ma'am.
And your wife was finally 8 months pregnant and terribly ill, correct?
Yes, ma'am, I believe so.
And you never went to see her?
No, ma'am, I was talking to her and checking on her, but I did not physically go there because I did not think it was safe to.
During the state's closing arguments, the prosecutor cut through the absurdity of Nicholas's story.
I submit to you, not a word he said, not a word of that makes any sense. Why was the divorce important? The divorce was important because he had to have a reason to be telling this whole Jim story to begin with. Nicholas Cassotis did not want to pay Heather Thomas one penny. He did not want to pay her the $1.6 million, and he didn't. And he absconded. I submit to you, there is no Jim. Jim started as a convenient reason to get away from Heather, to not pay the money, and he convinced Mindy. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, Mindy believed him. So did Cameron Nelson. So did Mindy's parents. He was a decorated lieutenant, 10 years almost with the JAG, 2 tours. Of course they believed him. It's easy to look at it now when you see all of this in front of you and say, who would believe that? People that didn't know all that. People that thought Nick and Mindy were telling them the truth.
At the end of the trial, the jury deliberated for just 1 hour.
State of Georgia versus Nicholas James Cassota. Count 1, malice murder, guilty. Count 2, felony murder, guilty.
The judge handed down his sentence on the same day.
This case has revealed a level of depravity that truly shocks the conscience. To put together this elaborate scheme, this web of lies, creating this fictional character, Jim McIntyre, who does not exist. Your life was a fiction, at least the last 6 or 7 years. And then you carried out a brutal, horrific, gruesome murder of Mindy, someone who's been described by various witnesses as beautiful, kind, loving, vibrant, smart, and all of her hopes and dreams vanished in an instant. Her life tragically cut short by you, someone who professed to love her, to care for her, just the ultimate betrayal. And then you desecrated her body in such a vile way. This shows beyond all doubt that you have no conscience. This is truly a heinous crime. And the court will now impose sentence that reflects the gruesome nature of your criminal conduct. As to count 1, malice murder, the court hereby imposes a sentence of life without the possibility of parole.
In the end, perhaps the most tragic aspect of this case isn't just that Mindy Cassotis lost her life. It's that her voice had been silenced long before her death. For years, Mindy lived inside a prison of fear that Nicholas had built around her. She trusted her husband, believed his lies. She rarely left the house. She spoke to others only through encrypted messages. She was convinced enemies were hunting her family, when in reality, the danger was beside her every night. It was a slow, methodical kind of torture, psychological, inescapable. Those who knew Mindy described her as bright, generous, and fiercely loyal, qualities that Nicholas exploited to maintain his elaborate deception. But today, her friends and family are determined that her memory not be defined by the way she died. They remember the life she lived. A daughter who adored her parents. A friend who made others laugh. A woman whose potential was cut tragically short. During impact statements at sentencing, Mindy's sister-in-law, Megan Mebbin, spoke on behalf of the family.
You've shown no guilt and absolutely no remorse. You haven't even shed a tear. You thrive on the illusion of power and attention. You're a pathological liar, sociopath, psychopath, murderer. You thought you were so much smarter than everyone else, but you aren't. Mindy was bright, beautiful, empathetic, confident, independent. She loved music and making others feel special. She always put her family and friends first. Mindy was taken too soon. This loss has impacted so many beyond our family. The emotional wound you have caused will never heal. We have comfort knowing she is in heaven now, free from the trials and scars of this earth. We have overcome hatred, darkness, and evil. She is looking down on us now, being proud of how we have overcome. We are done being victims. We are taking back our lives.
In choosing to take back their lives, Mindy's family reminds us of something simple but powerful. Even when violence tries to silence a voice, love can speak louder. Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.